yourself and your client and begin your argument.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Opposing counsel, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Olson, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Christopher Konikowicz. We are asking for the court to do one of two things. Excuse me. Either first reverse the conviction, as there is insufficient evidence, thereby applying double jeopardy and barring any further trial, or in the alternative, reversing and remanding for a new trial, as evidence that was presented in the case should have been suppressed. And we would ask that this court then suppress that evidence, not allow it at the new trial, and proceed forward. The reason why we believe that this case should just be completely reversed and conviction not be entered is because there isn't sufficient evidence based on the testimony in light of the most favorable to the verdict. Specifically, what we're talking about is there are two stories that have kind of been testified about by two children, CK and LK. And if you follow those stories, they cannot match. Yet the jury has convicted Mr. Konikowicz on both counts relating to both victims. It is impossible to have done that. And because of that, there are issues with the testimony that's been taken. As it had been outlined in my brief, specifically, if we were to follow CK's version of events, LK could not have been touched because of the position that they were in the bed, where everybody was, the time of day, and those situations don't all match. The only thing that really seems to be consistent is that this was a Halloween night 5+ years ago at that point when they first were interviewed by the police, and that they all slept in a bunk bed together at the bottom bunk. However, the contradictoriness of each statement means that you can't follow one child and agree with the other. You just can't. It would not make logical sense. There's no testimony that's taken, oh, well, this happened at one point. We switched in the night. We moved positions. Nothing like that. They're very firm in their stances that one child was, with one child's testimony, the person was at the end of the wall. One was in the middle of the bed, one is on the outside corner. And then the other child has a completely different version of where the children are. Further, based on the children's testimony, if it is to be accurate, the allegations of where Mr. Konikowicz had touched the children couldn't have been possible based on the structure of the bed and virtually how he would be able to do the claims that were made. The other issue that comes up is intent. And the issue with the intent is, while we understand that—
Ms. Olson, before you go on to the next sub-issue, isn't the jury permitted to find or to believe that certain parts of the witness's testimony are believable or credible or are true, and certain other parts are not true? And doesn't the case law governing our review for sufficiency of the evidence allow for those kinds of inconsistencies, give the jury the freedom to sort between the evidence and to rely on the parts of the evidence that it believes are true?
I certainly don't disagree that case law does say you can have inconsistencies, but the inconsistencies here would mean that you couldn't find guilt for one of the charges or the other. It's the inconsistencies are so great that if you found CK and her viewing of what happened in her testimony, then it would be impossible to find guilt against LK or on the charge with LK, because it wouldn't have been possible for him to do what he did or what has been alleged that he did.
And that makes it sound like the jury has to completely find one witness's testimony credible. And you know, as Judge Johnson was pointing out, can't they pick and choose? Couldn't the jury have said, look, we believe both of them when they said he was the perpetrator, that he touched them, but we don't agree with one of them on where they were in the beds? I mean, I think, isn't that something a jury is permitted to do?
not if it would not be logical and factual and found in fact. Again, you can find inconsistencies, but if the inconsistency would make it impossible to do the thing that happened, then no, I don't believe the jury has the right to make such a logic, make such statements, because it would mean that the person isn't credible or that something's impossible. If something physically can't happen based on the description of what is said by someone, we can't say juries are entitled to then find for that. It wouldn't make sense. It wouldn't be possible. And that's why juries are not infallible. We have these fact-finding and these reviews. The issue we run into is, like I was saying, the inconsistencies are so great that if you pick and choose, even if you tried to pick and choose, someone's version of the positions where the children are has to be decided. And if that were to happen, then the charge and the conviction couldn't happen for the other child. That is the issue we run into.
Why? Okay. Let's just assume for the moment that that the children were in, you know, that one child was against the wall versus being on the outside of the bed. Why does that make it impossible for him to do the act that he was alleged to have done? In other words, it was not a large bed. Isn't it easy enough for him to reach across another sleeping child and commit that act upon the child that's nearest the wall?
It's a bunk bed, Your Honor. So it isn't just an open air where you could just reach across. He would have had to physically get onto the bed and go over children, because there were three children on the bed. So even if one of the children were against the wall, we had two other children who would have had to notice him. And that's where also the further inconsistency comes up. Neither of the other two children said that they heard Mr. Konikowicz or saw Mr. Konikowicz on the bed. And even if you disregard one of the children, and because that isn't in light of most favorable to the verdict, the other child, the child that would have been believed, didn't notice or see him ever on the bed. That is why it would be impossible for this to happen. And in both children's testimony, one of the children was by the wall. And that is why we have such great inconsistency. Again, I do not dispute that you can have inconsistencies and juries can pick and choose, but they can't pick and choose in this instance because of the physical impossibility of the facts that the state presented. I mean, there is no dispute that it was a bunk bed. There is no dispute that the children were all together, lined up together in the bed. And it would be for Mr. Konikowicz to have done the allegation, he would have had to get onto the bed physically. And that would have been extremely difficult for him to do without rousing the other children. And the other child that was believed didn't mention that, didn't say that Mr. Konikowicz was on the bed, never even implied that Mr. Konikowicz was on the bed. And that's the other situation. If he were to have been on the bed and were to have done the allegations as purported by one of the children, it would have been something that would have been noticeable. If you follow the other child's logic, it still would have been noticeable. It would have been something that would have been mentioned, or as following the children and believing the children, they didn't notice it. They didn't notice Mr. Konikowicz there. They also couldn't identify that it was necessarily Mr. Konikowicz. They say they think it's him, but there was no verbal speaking. It was dark. They couldn't see him. They're saying that they were touched. And that leads into the implications of what happened, which is they heard about allegations from Mr. Konikowicz and things that he had done in his past. And that creates issues of the witness testimony, which again, you can ignore those situations, but it doesn't ignore the physical impossibilities of what was being accused and how it was being accused. This leads into, again, also the intent argument is that the state has really failed to show intent. It seems to be assumed there was some intent because of what the allegations are, but that alone is not enough. And I do not dispute that direct evidence of intent is not required. It's a state of mind. We can't do that. You use circumstantial evidence, but that circumstantial evidence does have a heightened standard on inferences. There's no evidence on one of the children who didn't allege that he touched private parts, but actually above her buttocks. That would be considered private parts of a child. There is no showing of did he do it for a different reason? They're young children. They're at their home. Now there's no evidence of what he was doing. It's just he touched me. And then there seems to be an assumption that the intent is there, but that isn't how the law is segregated. It's an element, and they must prove the intent was either aggressive or sexual. Now, there is no evidence that it was aggressive, and I don't think there's a dispute that they weren't searching for the intent to be considered aggressive. They were saying it was sexual, but automatically saying, well, if you touch someone's private areas, that can be presumed sexual is not in our case law, and I cannot find it in Minnesota case law anywhere that it says it's automatically presumed per se if that happens. And it is not the defendant's obligation to prove the intent. It is the state's, and the state did not prove it. There is nothing in the record that shows they acknowledge it more than the fact that he touched someone. Instead, what happened is they were able to use the Spriegel evidence that was improperly admitted as some type of bolster to the intent, which is not appropriate in the situation and why Spriegel should have been excluded. That's why if you do find maybe there is sufficiency of the evidence, we believe that the Spriegel evidence should not have been admitted. And because it was admitted, it prejudiced my client so badly that a new trial should be warranted. The Spriegel evidence is pretty clear. We shouldn't just provide Spriegel evidence when it's there and when it's offered by the state. It is a very clear analysis, which we have outlined, and it tends to lead if you don't, or if there's any question that the Spriegel could be prejudicial or problematic for the trial, then it should be excluded because it should err on the side and the benefit of the defense, not on the benefit of the prosecution. Here, we didn't follow that balancing test. The standard, there wasn't a showing that the evidence was clear and convincing. It wasn't relevant and material to this situation. And it is definitely more prejudicial than probative. And the
there's also, let me stop you on clear and convincing. I mean, first of all, I don't think you argued that in your brief, but second of all, he pleaded guilty to the incident with respect to JM, correct?
He did plead guilty, Your Honor.
So, but, I mean, doesn't that establish by clear and convincing evidence that it occurred?
I'm not disputing that clear and convincing evidence that it occurred, but when I view clear and convincing, that the clear and convincing standard is the appropriateness of using it at trial. And it wasn't just the 2001 incident. I'm also talking about the two other pending cases at that time. Those were clearly not clear and convincing that those situations had occurred. And those should not have been used for a bolstering of Spriegel evidence, but as relation just to the 2001 conviction. I will agree that it can be found that, but it doesn't meet the relevant and material, or that it was more probative than prejudicial.
The case law seems to provide, says that if the person has been convicted of the conduct in the other acts evidence, then that may provide the clear and convincing evidence. May we consider a subsequent conviction? In other words, after the either the pretrial ruling or after the trial in this case?
I did not see that in any Minnesota case law that it would be required. I think may does potentially allow it. But that's why the balancing test has three prongs to it, and you have to meet all three prongs. I do not think that it would be clear and convincing to have a subsequent conviction, because really at the time of the incidents, the conviction hadn't happened, which is a little different than in 2001, where we had a plea and we had certain descriptions. And further, the clear and convincing, and the reason why I also think this is at issue, is the crime itself, wasn't the same as the crime that was being alleged. And the plea did not discuss similar enough events to say that, again, I would argue it leads towards the second prong, which is relevant and material. And I see my time is up. May I finish?
Yes, you may finish that point and you may sum up.
Thank you. The relevance and material seems to be the biggest issue. The 2001 conviction and the subsequent trials that had occurred did not match anything similar to the scheme or modus operandi, which is the exception that the court applied. They weren't similar. The only similarity I could see is age of the children. They were more than 20 years ago. It had completely different connotations of what he was doing. And that is why it shouldn't have been allowed, and because it is prejudicial. To sum up, we are asking the court to find that there isn't sufficient evidence. And if there was sufficient evidence, or the court finds there to be, that the Spriegel evidence was improperly introduced and it should be reversed and remanded for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Jill Green, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this case. We are asking that this court affirm the jury's findings of guilt and convictions of Mr. Konikowicz. In addressing the sufficiency of evidence, I'll jump right into Ms. Olson's argument. The jury has the ability to believe and disbelieve portions of witnesses' statements. And in this case, where the children were in the bed varied in Mr. Konikowicz's own witnesses, and it really does not directly impact what they ultimately said happened or what the elements of the crime were, which is, did Mr. Konikowicz touch the children on their intimate parts on Halloween 2015?
Do you agree? Well, is it your position that the differences in testimony are reconcilable, or that even if they're not reconcilable, that doesn't matter? The jury can, as we've previously discussed, you know, accept one and reject the other.
Both. I frankly haven't looked in depth to draw myself a little diagram of whether the children were here or there and whether Mr. Konikowicz could have reached or not. I think the jury found sufficient evidence based on what the children said that he could have perpetrated both crimes, given especially that both children believed the other child to be asleep at the time it occurred, and that there was testimony on all fronts that the children moved during the night. But secondly, and more importantly, I think the jury received expert testimony about the significance of peripheral details from an expert witness on child memory. And specifically, she had talked about why peripheral details, such as where you are in the bed on the night of a traumatic incident 5 years ago, can be inconsistent, might not be something that a child would remember. And I think the case law supports that. As well, if you look at, apologies, let me pull it up. State v. Wright, 679 Northwest 2D 186, which I cited in my brief, talks about how inconsistencies are a sign of human fallibility and do not prove testimony is false, especially when the testimony is about a traumatic event. Here in this case, the event occurred in 2015, the trial occurred in 2021. The children were young. There were statements that they made to the forensic interviewer approximately 2 years before the trial had even occurred and at trial. And I think Ms. Gapsky, the expert witness, talked about how inconsistencies are consistent when we're talking about child sexual abuse. So I think they're reconcilable, and I think the jury can make its determination as to who was more credible on that issue. And I also just don't think it really, for the jury or myself, bears on whether or not Mr. Konikowicz actually touched these children. With respect to sufficiency.
Ms. Green, yeah. Does the fact that it was a bunk bed make it difficult or impossible for Mr. Konikowicz to have committed the acts?
just based upon common knowledge of a bunk bed, I imagine that Mr. Konikowitz could reach across. We know from the testimony that it was a twin bed on top and a full bed on bottom. The fact that it was a full bed means that half of the bed was actually an open space. The children testified about the side of the bed. I believe one of the children testified that Mr. Konikowitz could have crawled through the side where the ladder was. And so I don't think there's any merit to the argument that Mr. Konikowitz could not have been where the children said he was. He could not have reached each child.
Were all three children on the bottom bunk?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And of course, all three of the children were between 5 and 6 years old. They were very small. An adult could reach over them. And I think the jury found that in this case too. With respect to intimate parts, there is both direct testimony and multiple prior consistent statements that were admitted as substantive evidence. I went into this very in depth in my brief. However, LK clearly testified that Mr. Konikowitz was the perpetrator, that he rubbed her vagina. That was corroborated by her statements to her stepmother and her mother, both of whom provided prior statements that the jury received as substantive evidence and testimony, all of which corroborated that Mr. Konikowitz touched the or rubbed the vaginal area of LK. With respect to CK, there was substantive and direct testimony from multiple parties about Mr. Konikowitz or her statements that Mr. Konikowitz touched her privates. Specifically, there was testimony from her. The transcript says where her butt. I personally recall that she said near her butt, but we're obviously going off the transcript here. She stated it was a few inches from her butt. If the jury simply believed that statement of hers, that it was a few inches from her butt, there is case law that says that would constitute the primary genital area. And I went very in depth in that in citing specific cases, Roche, Hansen, and Bain, talking about the expansive nature of what is the primary genital area. And so for that reason, I think only that statement in itself is sufficient. But here we also have more direct testimony and prior statements, including the child's direct testimony that she told her mom and stepmom that Mr. Konikowicz touched her privates, which she defined in a forensic interview as her vaginal area.
Ms. Green, the definition of intimate parts is that it includes the primary genital area, comma, groin, comma, inner thigh, comma, buttocks, comma, or breast of a human being. So it seems that even if he didn't touch her buttocks, he may have touched her groin or inner thigh, perhaps. Does the evidence reflect whether, to the extent that the evidence says near her buttocks, does it indicate whether he touched above or below her buttocks?
I don't believe she at any point says above her buttocks. I had understood it to say below, but I don't see anywhere whether her specifying whether or not it was above or below her buttocks. Nonetheless, she did also state on direct that she said that he touched her privates or told others that he touched her privates. This is further corroborated by the stepmother's direct and mother's direct testimony and prior statements, which were that CK had told them that Mr. Konikowitz had touched her privates. She had defined privates in that forensic interview. There's also case law that says, the word privates for a child, you can essentially infer that those are the intimate parts. I think the specific language is that the average juror would associate intimate parts with private areas of the body associated with sexual activity, and that State v. Bain, which is an unpublished case, 2017, Westlaw 16441. But nonetheless, the jury had a child in this case who came in and who testified that he had touched near or where her butt a few inches, that she had told people that he had touched her privates, a forensic interview that said that he touched her butt, a forensic interview that was closer in time to what had occurred, which was received as substantive evidence. So for all of those reasons, and the prior statements she had given to her mother and stepmother, which were consistent with that. So for all of those reasons, that substantive evidence in and of itself is enough in viewing the facts most favorable to the verdict for this court to affirm on the sufficiency of evidence argument. With respect to sexual or aggressive intent, Mr. Konikowicz agrees that it can be readily inferred from the nature of the conduct. State v. Vick, in particular, a 632 Northwest 2D 676, talks about rubbing of the vagina or rubbing of the buttocks negates a possibility of an innocent explanation, such as an accidental touching or touching in the course of caregiving. I think it's fairly obvious here, and it was to the jury too, that there is absolutely no innocent explanation for an adult man to sneak into a bunk bed where children are sleeping at night and putting his hand below his pajamas to touch their intimate parts, their buttocks, and rub their vagina. It's so easily inferred from those facts and the circumstances that I don't think that argument has any merit. Nonetheless, the Spriegel evidence, initially it was noticed as to prove intent or common scheme or plan. It was withdrawn as to evidence of intent. I think in retrospect, it could have been used to prove sexual intent in this case, but nonetheless, it was used to prove common scheme or plan. If we move on then to the argument that the Spriegel evidence was wrongfully admitted or there was a reasonable probability that the result of the proceeding would have been different, I'm asking this court to find there was no error. In part because the court very thoroughly analyzed the five factors under Clark. There was notice, there was clear and convincing evidence that it had happened. Mr. Konikowicz had pled guilty to JM. He, at the time of trial, had been convicted or the jury had found him guilty as to BK. But nonetheless, a victim's statement in and of itself is sufficient to provide clear and convincing evidence that is clear from case law. With respect to relevance and materiality, there is a case that I feel is quite similar. It's State v. Tomlinson, which is 938 Northwest 2D 282, in which they talk about the similarities in similarly situated victims. So the closeness in age, the closeness or the pattern of behavior in abusing a position as a trusted individual to gain access to these children. And in Tomlinson, the incidents are even more remote in time. I also note that concern about remoteness in time is lessened if Mr. Konikowicz was actually convicted of the crimes, which is what we have here. And that is from Clark. And that is because it prevents a defendant from defending against conduct that occurred many years ago. Alleged conduct, whereas if you have a conviction, it's clear and convincing. So here it was 20 years ago at the time of trial, but at the time that he committed the offense, which was Halloween 2015, it was actually 12 to 15 years ago with respect to BK and 13 years ago with respect to JM.
Is the case law clear that we measure time from as between the two incidents, or do we measure it from the date of the alleged other act as compared to the current trial?
I don't believe, or I don't know offhand whether there's something that explicitly says you measure it from the time of offense, but just in reading the case law, it seems to indicate that it is measured from the time that the offense occurred. And that would make more sense if you're talking about a pattern, because if something happened in 2015, you're trying it in 2020. It still happened in 2015. It happened in 2001. It would make more sense to measure it from the time of offense.
I have a question about, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I have a question about similarity, I guess, and it's sort of how similar must it be? And there's the phrase marked similarity. I mean, I think you make the argument in your brief that, you know, the current offenses as well as the Spiegel incidents all occurred in either his home or the home of his partner. I mean, that isn't that commonly true with this type of offense? They're in a home. That's just, you know, that's where sexual offenses often occur, and with children probably more so. So, I mean, is that really enough to show a marked similarity, or do we need more information about the manner in which the offenses were committed in order to meet that test?
I would agree that you need more evidence. A place is simply one of the things you would consider in determining time, place, modus operandi, and in determining whether there is a marked similarity. In this case, it happened that all of the offenses occurred where Mr. Konikowicz was living at the time. And so that's why I found it significant. It didn't occur in the victim's home. It was just one more factor, I think, that bears on it. But more importantly, all of these children were children with whom he was either a household member or a relative, and in the majority of them, he was babysitting. Since I have 14 seconds, I'm just going to broadly cover the rest, which is, even if it should not have been admitted under Spiegel, it would have been admitted under as relationship evidence, or would likely have been admitted under. I apologize, I'm out of time. Would you like me to continue?
Yes, you may. You may briefly summarize other points, and then you may sum up.
Thank you. I was just going to say that, and I think this is covered quite well in my brief anyway, but it would have been admitted as relationship evidence, which had an even lower standard than Spiegel admission. And more importantly, I think the prejudice was extremely minimized. The court even remarked on how minimized it was. Instead of presenting that live graphic in-person testimony from JM and BK, which the court had already heard from other trials, the state simply admitted the verdict and did not dwell on it, and there were multiple cautionary instructions whenever a witness talks. So for all of those reasons, any error was not sufficient to rise to the level that the verdict would have been different. And so for those reasons, we're requesting you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Green. Ms. Olson, as stated previously, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to focus a little bit on the Spiegel evidence. This is something that just got pointed out, was the court had heard all this evidence prior. The court isn't at issue, it's the jury, and whether or not the jury should have heard that evidence. The court could have heard the evidence 10,000 times, one time, two times, that doesn't matter. The issue is this evidence did not create a clear modus operandi plan or scheme. As shown, it's not so close. It's not about just the timing and everything that happened with it, but it's not close in what was alleged. What was alleged in the other crimes in 2001 and the conviction and the plea was not just merely touching above or below the buttocks or rubbing the vaginal area, if that were to be believed and true. There were other things. There were talks of penetration and different situations here, which, again, are graphic in detail, but that is why we don't necessarily allow Spiegel evidence, and we lean to not allowing it if it's going to be extremely prejudicial. Hearing that that happened in 2001 means that it can trigger in a jury's mind, it must have happened again here. That's why it becomes a prejudicial issue, and it is less probative because it doesn't show a plan or scheme. Saying, well, he's in a babysitting capacity. He was not in a babysitting capacity on Halloween night. He wasn't. They were trick-or-treating with his family, but that doesn't mean he was the personal caregiver of those children. He was doing that with other families. They were spending the night at the home. It isn't true that they were all at his home. The 2001 situation, he was in the home with the victim. It was the victim's home as well. And this babysitting situation would tend again, there seems to be this implication. He was babysitting or he was a subject of authority, but that isn't shown in the record that that's what he was doing on that night. That doesn't show that he snuck into the room or that that was something he always did or it was towards that. Regarding the relationship.
Ms. Olson, I mean, isn't it true that he and his wife together collectively were responsible for the children? The children, there was an agreement that the children would stay at their home. And the appellant's wife, I believe, told some of the children's mother, I'll be there, and so on. I mean, he may not have been solely either babysitting or caring for them, but he was responsible for them while they were in, he and his wife are responsible for the children while they were in their home, correct?
I agree that mother said she would be the caregiver for the children. I believe that's what pans out. I don't believe that they ever said that father would, or, and I'm saying father, excuse me, Mr. Konikowicz would have been watching. But nonetheless, that also negates this scheme or plan. Based on the scheme or plan of the other incidents and what was accused is he did this alone when no other adult was present, when it was just him and the children. This is a situation where his wife is there. That would tend to lead that why he wouldn't follow that same pattern, because he has another adult there and he absolutely didn't do that in those other situations. So this is just to be used to bolster the intent. And as said, Ms. Green withdrew the request to use it towards the intent situation. So it was just to say, well, it's a similar scheme and plan. So because of that, this had to have happened, or it's similar enough that it should be inferred. Regarding that relationship.
Ms. Olson, the district court cited the Tomlinson case and respondent state puts heavy reliance on that in their responsive brief. How would you respond to that argument? You did not do a reply brief, so I'm curious what your position is about the applicability of Tomlinson.
I think Tomlinson, I guess in my situation, I don't believe Tomlinson is necessary, or I guess part of the overarching situation. I think we have a very specific case and Clark factors, and that's what we should use. I know that it was heavily cited in the brief. I didn't make a reply, and that's because I believed under the Clark factors, which are the factors that the judge used and the factors that are to be used, there wasn't evidence of it. Again, I think the difference in Tomlinson is that the plan and scheme, and I see I'm out of time. May I finish?
I apologize. Yes, you may finish your answer to the question.
Thank you. I believe Tomlinson in that situation, there were more factors that were similar enough, which could have led to it. In this case, there were enough factors that weren't similar enough and actually would have contradicted the plan and scheme that he had in 2001. So it would not have met similar to Tomlinson. And I think Clark is the more important factor, and that's what we use because that is the standard. So to me, Tomlinson is not relevant. I think you can look at the cases and compare them and contrast them, but it would not be appropriate to use Tomlinson.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Your time has expired. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted and the court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days. We will now make a transition to the second oral argument case.